Travel ban or Muslim ban? Today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. Critics call President Trump's travel ban a Muslim ban. And today, the Supreme Court heard that side of the argument.
Principally, it's a question of whether or not the government can single out and punish an entire group of people simply because of who they are.
And the government's response?
This is not a so-called Muslim ban. If it were, it would be the most ineffective Muslim ban that one could possibly imagine.
Plus, a trade battle over catfish hits home in Greensboro, Alabama.
In this area of Alabama, it's one of the biggest economic drivers, and it creates a lot of jobs and what would be considered a pretty poor area in the state.
Those stories and more on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. Lots to get to today, including an interview with former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and a story about how catfish got caught up in America's trade wars. But let's start with a case before the Supreme Court today. The justices heard oral arguments challenging President Donald Trump's travel ban, the most recent one. The ban is mostly aimed at people from several Muslim-majority countries. Some opponents of the executive order have dubbed it a Muslim ban. But speaking before the court today, Solicitor General Noel Francisco, representing the Trump administration, argued this.
This is not a so-called Muslim ban. If it were, it would be the most ineffective Muslim ban that one could possibly imagine, since not only does it exclude the vast majority of the Muslim world, it also omits three Muslim-majority countries that were covered by past orders, including Iraq, Chad, and Sudan. And so this order is what it purports to be and what its process and substance confirms that it is. It is an order that is based on a multi-agency worldwide review that applied neutral criteria all across the world and concluded under those neutral criteria, most of the world was fine, but a small part of it failed to provide us with that minimum baseline of information, the minimum, not the ideal, the bare minimum, terrorism history, criminal history, that we need to protect the country.
Solicitor General Noel Francisco arguing the Trump administration's case for a travel ban in front of the Supreme Court today. Human rights attorney Azadeh Shashahani watched the proceedings from inside the courtroom. I asked her about the main arguments made by the Trump administration.
Well, what they are saying is that the ban only targets five Muslim-majority countries as opposed to, you know, the entire Muslim world, and so it is narrowly tailored to focus on specific countries, and that it is not discriminatory, and it is motivated by national security.
Was there pushback to that argument?
Well, definitely the justices were asking really good questions, actually. One of them said, well, what if, you know, a future president makes all of these anti-Semitic remarks in the course of his campaign, and then after he gets elected, basically directs his administration to ban the entry of all Jews? Would you view that any differently? And the justices were also zoning in on the issue of the waivers, because under the latest version of the Muslim ban, there's supposedly a waiver available. But all the news reports have indicated that only two individuals have been granted a waiver. And so the justices were mentioning, for example, that the 10-year-old girl with cerebral palsy has been denied a waiver. And there are many other cases of individuals with serious illnesses, professors or students who need to be in academic institutions, that they have been denied a waiver.
And I imagine the issue of national security came up. Was that a big point that the Trump administration lawyers made?
Right. That's, you know, that's a point that the Trump administration kept pushing. And, you know, the other side, the state of Hawaii was arguing that Congress already has a scheme available for that, that is, you know, well articulated and well thought out. And so the president is basically, deciding to go above and beyond. And that basically, goes beyond what he's able to do. He does not have the authority to just issue a flat ban against individuals from five Muslim-majority countries.
Of course, those countries are Iran, Libya, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. I'm wondering, what were the main points made by Neil Katyal? He represents Hawaii, which is pushing this case.
Right. One of the points that he was making was that this third version of the Muslim ban goes beyond his authority, the authority of a president, especially when Congress already has a scheme in place. The other point that he was making is that this amounts to discrimination on the basis of nationality in granting of visas. And then lastly, and, you know, very importantly, is that this is basically religious discrimination. I think for many of us, it's very clear that this is still a Muslim ban, despite what the Trump administration is saying and how they've tried to dress it up. Neil Katyal also made the point, for example, that the president, a lot of the Islamophobic remarks he made in the course of his campaign in the lead up to the elections. But as president, he retweeted three Islamophobic videos from, you know, an Islamophobic and racist organization in Europe. And, you know, he did not apologize or anything like that. And so, you know, it's very clear what the motivation behind the Muslim ban is.
What are the core issues here that the court has to decide, and how may they set a precedent?
Well, obviously, they need to decide whether the Muslim ban stays or goes. We hope they strike it down. But one of the issues that they need to decide on was the extent of his authority. Obviously, the issue of whether the Muslim ban discriminates against Muslims and so as such, you know, violates the Constitution, that issue also needs to be decided on. And anything that comes out of the Supreme Court is going to set a precedent.
People have been waiting for this case, this third version of the travel ban. Were there any surprises today at the Supreme Court?
No, I don't think that there weren't surprises. You know, I was glad that justices had probing questions and they had obviously looked at the briefs and thought deeply about the issues. And that was really encouraging to see. I think it's hard to tell in terms of which way, you know, the Supreme Court will rule. You know, we hope that the Supreme Court will strike down the ban, but regardless, the fight will go on.
Azadeh Shashahani there. She's the legal and advocacy director for a human rights organization called Project South. For some, this Supreme Court case brings back memories of 1944. That's the year the justices ruled in a landmark case called Korematsu versus the United States. The case challenged the legality of placing Japanese Americans in internment camps during World War II. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the U.S. government. Hale Yasui is a filmmaker and the daughter of Minoru Yasui. His case went to the Supreme Court in the 1940s, along with those of Fred Korematsu and Gordon Hirabayashi. Hale, you joined the children of the other two men in filing an amicus brief in the travel ban case. Tell us about the parallels you see between your father's case and the travel ban and what points you wanted to make to the court.
There are many parallels between the Muslim ban and the Japanese American internment from World War II. Principally, it's a question of whether or not the government can single out and punish an entire group of people simply because of who they are. In the case of Japanese Americans back in World War II, it was for no other reason, for no crimes that they were accused of, but simply being Japanese Americans. Likewise, today, there are whole groups of people based on national origin, Syria being a case in point, but also the other four Muslim-majority countries, who are being discriminated against simply because of their national background. No due process, no trials, no hearings to determine whether or not every single person in that group is a terrorist in the case of today or back in World War II. They determine whether or not the 120,000 people who were detained were in fact Japanese spies. History proves that in fact there were none. None of the people who were detained were ever found to be traitors to the United States. No espionage, no sabotage. So that, to me, is the most important parallel between the Muslim ban today and the Japanese-American internment back during World War II.
One difference that's being pointed out is that the internment of Japanese-Americans in World War II, that was especially egregious because it affected U.S. citizens. And in the Trump attempts at a ban, these are non-citizens from overseas. Is that an important difference to you?
It is an important difference on the one hand, but some people are not aware of the fact that the first generation Japanese Americans, they were called Issei, the immigrants. They were not U.S. citizens. The reason they were not U.S. citizens is because they were not allowed to become U.S. citizens. That's part of the history of U.S. immigration law. Back in 1940s, all Asians were prohibited from becoming U.S. citizens. So the difference, of course, is they were not abroad. They were in the United States, but they were aliens. Our contention is that aliens, as well as citizens, have due process rights. Under the Constitution, we're supposed to apply equal justice under the law, regardless of whether you are a U.S. citizen or a foreign national. So the issue of citizenship is legally an important point, but on the humanitarian level, I think we need to look at this as whether or not discrimination is constitutional and is it moral.
Now, the 1944 Supreme Court ruling in Korematsu versus the United States, it's been widely criticized by legal scholars, but it's never been overturned. Is part of your motivation in filing the amicus brief to make sure that the Korematsu ruling would not be used as a precedent?
On some level, yes. Unfortunately, only the U.S. Supreme Court can overrule itself. And the case has already been adjudicated. So what is at question, what is at stake now is not the World War II cases, but of course the Muslim ban. What we're hoping is that in the arguments, in the decision, that consideration will be made with regard to the way that the Japanese American internment cases were decided. In the 1940s, the U.S. Supreme Court basically deferred to the government's arguments of military necessity. Now, the government is asking the court to defer to the justification of national security. So even though we can't actually overrule the Japanese American cases, we are hoping that that historical wrong can be righted, be disavowed and repudiated indirectly in the arguments and in the decision of the Muslim ban case.
Your father, Minoru Yasui, was a lawyer. How do you think he'd see this case?
I know he would be glad to see it coming up before the U.S. Supreme Court because he was a great believer in the fact that what was happening to Japanese Americans was not only an injustice against Japanese Americans, it was a question of justice in general for all Americans. So I do think that he himself would be the amicus on this brief and not myself, because he was trained in law and a very firm believer in equal justice under the law for all persons, regardless of race, regardless of religion, for innocent until proven guilty. He was a firm, firm believer, a great patriot in terms of wanting to always defend the United States' professed values and principles of democracy.
Holly, what will you be watching for as this case moves forward in the Supreme Court?
I'm particularly interested in Neil Katyal, who is the attorney for the state of Hawaii, because it was Katyal who actually issued a statement of error with regard to the Japanese American cases. And so Katyal is very conscious, very aware of this historical precedent, how it was wrong. And so I'm hoping that Katyal will, in fact, bring up the Japanese American cases as examples of what the court should not do. There are some really important and fundamental principles at stake, and I think it is something that the justices will take into consideration.
Holly Yasui is a filmmaker and the daughter of Minoru Yasui, one of the men who challenged the legality of sending Japanese Americans to internment camps during World War II. Thanks, Holly.
Thank you.
Coming up, what's on the trade war menu? Catfish. You're with the world. I'm Carol Hills, and you're tuned to The World. Lots of talk about tariffs and trade wars these days, but when talk turns into action, there are consequences. Case in point, catfish. Yep. In fact, there's a 17-year-old skirmish going on between the U.S. and Vietnam over catfish. We sent The World's Jason Margolis to Greensboro, Alabama, to get the story.
Let's go look at some catfish ponds.
Townsend Kaiser is a third-generation catfish farmer in Greensboro, the catfish capital of Alabama.
I don't know how it got the designation, but we're proud to have a catfish industry in Greensboro as well as in this area of Alabama. It's one of the biggest economic drivers in our area, and it creates a lot of jobs and what would be considered a pretty poor area in the state.
Kaiser has about 50 ponds stocked with some 6 million catfish. Since the U.S. and Vietnam signed a bilateral trade agreement in 2001, it's been a struggle for southern catfish farmers. Most are concentrated in Alabama and Mississippi. Kaiser, who is also president of the Catfish Farmers of America, says the domestic catfish industry has been cut in half over the past 15 years.
It was a perfect storm. Our feed cost doubled, price of grain doubled, electricity and fuel doubled, and at the exact same time, imports started to ramp up, and they were a cheaper alternative.
Southern catfish farmers have tried several tactics to slow imports from Vietnam. First, they said, this catfish from Vietnam, it's not even catfish.
People were calling it catfish, and a lot of people were confused by that.
Vietnamese farmers weren't confused. They said, we're raising catfish, just an Asian species. Still, U.S. federal law was changed, so Asian imports could not be labeled as catfish. And yet, frozen Vietnamese, don't call them catfish fish, kept coming into the United States. Then southern catfish farmers like Townsend Kaiser said government-subsidized Vietnamese fish imports were violating trade rules.
I'm not opposed to fair competition. Good competition makes everybody stronger, but they were dumping them into our markets and stealing the markets that we had spent 40 years building.
Dumping means selling a product for less than fair market value. It's a tactic used to gain market share to wipe out your competitors. The U.S. government again agreed with the American catfish farmers and 15 years ago put hefty duties up to 63% on Vietnamese imports. But Vietnamese fish was still cheaper and kept coming into the U.S. So the Catfish Farmers of America adopted another strategy. Townsend Kaiser says this about imported white fish from Vietnam.
I would not eat it. It's grown in the Mekong River Delta, which is one of the most polluted water systems in the world. No, you're not going to drop dead, but there could be some concerns about long-term exposure to some of the things that they are using.
The organization International Rivers ranks the Mekong Delta as having the worst water quality of any major river basin on Earth. So the American catfish farmers lobbied to change the inspection process. Seafood imports are regulated by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, but no longer catfish. That responsibility recently shifted to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which has a stricter inspection process. And that's been controversial. A U.S. Government Accountability Office report called imported catfish a low-risk food and said new inspections would, quote, likely not enhance the safety of catfish. Critics say the new inspections amount to a backdoor tariff. Arizona Senator John McCain has called them a brazen waste of taxpayer dollars. Here he is on the Senate floor back in 2015.
The true purpose of the catfish program is to create a trade barrier to protect a small handful of catfish farmers in two or three southern states. Let's be clear about what this is all about.
McCain has been a leading proponent of more normalized trade relations between the U.S. and Vietnam. He warns that Vietnam could retaliate and erect trade barriers against U.S. cotton, wheat, pork, soybeans, eggs, and fruit. In recent weeks, the catfish wars have gotten even more intense. The U.S. Department of Commerce applied new tariffs, the highest taxes ever applied on Vietnamese catfish. I reached out to multiple Vietnamese government agencies to ask about all of this, but didn't hear back. In the past, the Vietnamese government has called American tactics a smear campaign to benefit the interests of affluent southern farmers. They're now appealing the latest tariffs at the World Trade Organization. Adam Sitkoff in Hanoi sides with the Vietnamese.
This stuff that the U.S. is doing to try to hold back the Vietnamese fish, it's just pretty silly if you're looking at it, at this from any sort of a point of logic.
Sitkoff runs the American Chamber of Commerce in Hanoi, which promotes increased trade and investment between the U.S. and Vietnam. He eats Vietnamese whitefish, says it's safe, and by the way, calls it catfish.
I think anyone that eats it calls it catfish.
He says adding all these barriers to trade, the people getting hurt are American consumers who buy seafood.
They're just paying more money for the same fish that they would have gotten at a less expensive price. So we see this as just a form of protectionism, and it's not something that's going to bring back a lot of jobs or really help a lot of people.
These are some of the first ponds that we built.
In Greensboro, Townsend Kaiser says tariffs aren't just about protecting a few catfish farmers. He says when they go out of business, everybody around here suffers.
Even as much as the dentist office. We had a new dentist move to town when the worst happened about 10 years ago. He actually called me because he's about my age and wanted to know if he'd offended anyone because his business had gone down so much. It just trickles down into everything.
And even if you don't care about the local Greensboro economy, Kaiser makes one final appeal to buy American-raised catfish.
I think it tastes better, but that may be a personal opinion.
For The World, Jason Margolis, Greensboro, Alabama.
Frying catfish is a great thing to take to a tailgate that's something different.
It's all about catfish. Jason's story is part of our 50 States project, looking at how globalization is impacting communities across America. You can find more of our reporting at PRI.org. And there's just enough time for a reminder before we take a break. Recently, we asked you to send in stories of times when you either gave or received a random act of kindness. We asked because of Bren Bataclan. He's an artist we featured whose act of kindness is to give away his paintings to strangers. Here's one story we received. Listener Kelly Jocelyn remembers the time she took her children to a fast food restaurant to get lunch. She says she had limited money, so going out, even to a fast food restaurant, was a big deal. After Jocelyn's family ordered, they noticed a homeless man behind them in line. Jocelyn writes that the man went up to the counter and the clerk was very rude, abrupt, and refused to take his order. She says she then stepped in and told the cashier she was going to pay for the man's meal. "Let him order what he wants," Jocelyn told the fast food worker. "The homeless man looked at us through tears and thanked us several times," writes Jocelyn. She says her kids have never forgotten that moment. Talking about paying it forward, and now we want to pay it forward with the help of Bren Bataclan. He wants to give you a painting. Just go to The World's Facebook page and share your random act of kindness. Bataclan will be back on the show next week to pick his two favorites. Each will receive one of Bataclan's paintings. Again, just leave your story on The World's Facebook page. I'm Carol Hills. President Trump's effort to end the DACA program has just been dealt a big setback in court.
The court said if you're going to end a program that people plan their lives around, you have to have some kind of rational reason for it. And you haven't given us one yet, and you have 90 days to try again.
The latest update on DACA, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Since last September, the Trump administration has been taking steps to end the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, commonly known as DACA. But Trump's efforts to do so have faced setbacks along the way, including orders from federal judges to keep DACA in place for those who already have it. Today, the Trump administration is facing what might be its biggest setback yet on getting rid of DACA. This one also comes in the form of a ruling issued by a federal judge in Washington, D.C. For more on what this means, let's turn to Lily Axelrod. She's an immigration attorney based in Memphis, Tennessee. We often have her on to talk about the latest on the DACA program. Lily, what exactly is in this ruling?
So this ruling doesn't change anything immediately. It's on hold for 90 days for the government to respond. But if the ruling does go into effect 90 days from now, it says that in addition to renewing DACA applications for folks who already have it, the government is going to have to start accepting new applications from folks who have never had DACA before.
So those are the people who have either become eligible for DACA or who never applied for it before.
Exactly. So folks who are too young to apply before. I've encountered a number of people who had DACA applications sent back because they made a mistake on the forms and then they didn't have a chance to send their application again before Trump ended the program. So that would give folks another opportunity to apply.
So this DACA thing is getting hard to follow, but isn't the gist that the court says the Trump administration has not yet made an effective case for why DACA is unconstitutional?
That's exactly right. The courts have said, and this court said again yesterday, that the Trump administration has not actually managed to articulate either that the DACA program is unconstitutional or that even if it's perfectly legal, that they have some kind of rational reason for ending it. The court also emphasized that when you're ending a government program, you have to take into account the people who have relied on it. So in this case, we have 800,000 DACA beneficiaries who have relied on the fact that if they did the right thing and followed the law, they would be able to continue to be authorized to work and be protected from deportation. So they planned their education, their careers, and in many cases, they planned marriage and family around the assumption that if they did the right thing, they would continue to be protected. So the court said, if you're going to end up a program that people plan their lives around, you have to have some kind of rational reason for it. And you haven't given us one yet, and you have 90 days to try again.
So at this point, the Trump administration has 90 days to come up with a more muscular explanation for why getting rid of DACA is constitutional. But for the sake of argument, what if they don't? Then what happens?
If the government doesn't provide any reason in the next 90 days, or if they're not able to provide a reason that's persuasive to the court, then the court's order will go into effect and the DACA program will resume as it existed before the Trump administration tried to end it last September. And anyone who has DACA will be able to apply to travel using advance parole if they have a humanitarian reason to travel abroad or if they need to travel for work or school. But advance parole is on hold right now.
But would it still require DACA recipients to keep renewing every 2 years, or would it finally settle their status?
No, it would not settle their status. It would put DACA recipients back into the same situation that they were in last summer before Trump ended the program. They would have to continue to pay their fee, do their fingerprints, and send a new application every 2 years. They still don't have a pathway to citizenship or permanent status in the U.S. So Congress ultimately has the responsibility to fix this problem, not the administration and not the courts.
Okay, so what if the Trump administration puts forward an explanation for why it's unconstitutional, the court accepts it, then what?
If the Trump administration either manages to say that DACA is unconstitutional, or they come up with some kind of legitimate policy reason that's rational about why they ended the executive program, then they will be able to end the DACA program, which means that hundreds of thousands of young people would be thrown back into limbo and would be vulnerable to deportation. They would lose their jobs. They would lose their ability to lawfully drive in the United States, and they would be thrown back into limbo and back into the shadows.
Lily Axelrod, she's an immigration attorney based in Memphis, Tennessee. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
If you're brave enough, get online and do a search for Culiacan, Mexico. You'll find photo essays of the graves of murder victims and references to Joaquin El Chapo Guzman and the Sinaloa drug cartel. That's because Culiacan is a center of drug trafficking in Mexico, and that makes it one of the most violent cities in the country. But in that same web search, you might also stumble upon an essay by a Mexico City-based writer named Ana Karina Zatarain. It's on an arts and culture website called Hyperallergic, and it's about a big sculpture park in the middle of Culiacan, which is where Karina lived as a teenager. Karina, you describe your hometown Culiacan as a place of funerals and news of hostage taking and where government-enforced curfews kept you home at night as a teenager, but it's also a city with this massive park full of art. Can you describe it for us?
Yes, well, the Culiacan Botanical Garden started as a garden and began to have donations from a local businessman who collects contemporary art. So this started around 10 years ago, and by now it has almost 40 pieces by different artists. It's a really amazing sculpture park as well as botanical garden.
And I'm wondering about the art in the park. Does it reflect the violence of the city, or is it a relief from it?
Well, most of the artworks actually are a reflection of not just the violence in the city, but just the way of life of people in general in that region. So each one of the pieces was commissioned specifically for the site, and the artists really had to go through a whole process of understanding the context of Culiacan and the fears and interests and ways of life of the people who live there. That way, each one of the art pieces is kind of a reflection of the culture.
You write about the culture in your essay. You know, Culiacan is your hometown. Mm-hmm. And you write about your ambivalence about the city and what it's like to go back and visit. You know, you left when you were 18. And you write, the city and its inhabitants, once so familiar, now strike me as surreal. I'm wondering, what are some of the things that were normal to you then when you were growing up that now you realize really aren't so normal?
Well, first of all, the murders. It's a very strange thing when murder is normalized in a city to the point where people talk about it in a way that it's not really terrible anymore. You know, they say, well, yeah, they threw some heads in the government building. That kind of thing for me when I was growing up had become very commonplace. And now it's such a strange thing to look back on, like the way that I would be in school and you could hear helicopters that were looking for someone above you. And then several of my friends have been affected by it. Either one of their family members has been murdered or taken hostage, that kind of thing. At that moment, it didn't seem too odd.
When you visit Culiacan, do you visit the sculpture park?
I always go. I always make it a point to go several times.
What does it do for you personally?
Well, for me personally, I left Culiacan as soon as I turned 18. I left for college and I studied architecture. The park was intervened by a really important Mexican architect, Tatiana Bilbao. I also started getting very interested in contemporary art. That's when I started to constantly visit it and think about how amazing it is for this small, anonymous, broken town to have this beautiful, serene place. And so I think that's why I'm really kind of obsessed with this place. I think it's just a very unique situation that I haven't really seen anywhere else in the world, especially the quality of the artists. You know, like the artists that are present in the Botanical Garden are actually really renowned artists internationally. You know, you have Olafur Eliasson, Gabriel Orozco. There's a James Turrell installation, which is really beautiful. And, you know, you would expect to see those artists in these major museums of New York or Paris or London. So it kind of doesn't really make much sense for them to have pieces there in the middle of Culiacan, Mexico, but there they are.
I understand you have a favorite work of art there. It's called Encounter. Can you describe it for us?
Yeah, that's actually the James Turrell installation. So it's a small dome structure. I think about 12 people fit in there. There's an oval opening at the top. That's the only opening it has. And you can only visit it during the hour before nightfall, the hour before daybreak. Culiacan is actually well known for having beautiful sunsets. The sky gets really pink and orange, and James Turrell's Encounter kind of like frames that in this oval opening, and the rest of the dome structure just projects light on its own, and it's really bright colors that are changing. So I think it's beautiful that it kind of protects visitors from, you know, the surrounding hardship that they're living every single day in this kind of enclosed tiny space, and they just have to look up because that's the only thing to do in there and kind of be surrounded by all these colors. It's a really beautiful experience.
Ana Karina Zatarain is a writer based in Mexico City. She wrote about the Culiacan Botanical Garden for Hyperallergic, the art and culture website. Thanks, Karina.
Thank you.
The India-Pakistan border can be a forbidding one. The two countries have been at war on and off since the late 1940s, and these days there are huge bureaucratic hurdles in traveling from one country to the other. But cell phones and social media are now enabling Pakistanis and Indians to talk, even flirt with each other like never before. It's something that's become increasingly popular in gay communities in both countries. From Lahore, Pakistan, my BBC colleague Sekunder Kermani has a story.
I wasn't really looking for someone across the border. It just, I came across them and, you know, we disconnected. That's it. And it's been years and years now.
I'm scrolling through the homepage of a gay dating app with Ali, not his real name, a gay Pakistani man from Lahore.
They're more straight people, heterosexual people on these apps. So for them, you know, they're actually spoiled for choice.
Whereas you guys have to look a bit...
We have to struggle a lot.
Most of the profiles are just pictures of naked torsos, but some users have uploaded selfies with their faces. And because we're less than 20 miles away from the border with India, Some of the profiles belong to Indian men.
I've never met him, but thanks to FaceTime, now we're super connected.
Ali has formed one particularly close friendship with a gay man in India.
Like, if he's out and about in India, he'll show me around. He's going to a dinner and he'll literally take me with him and show me, oh, this is the restaurant I'm at and this is what I'm having. And I do the same thing.
It's just a shame, I guess, it's so hard to meet in real life.
Yeah, that is the sad bit, yeah.
Pakistan and India have fought three wars against each other over the past 70 years. Travel between the two neighbouring countries is extremely difficult. But now some residents are using dating apps to form friendships and relationships across the border. It's become particularly common in the gay community.
Pakistan and India have the same cultures. And it is not from now, it's from many centuries.
Adil Gondal works in finance in Lahore and has formed a number of online relationships with men in India.
We focus on the guy, on the next guy who is talking with us and how he talk and how he smile, how he speak. We are not in that, oh, that he speaks good, but he's from India, no.
Has anyone ever said anything negative about Pakistan that you didn't like?
Definitely, because you know that all five fingers are not equal. They said you are like a very terrorist type people. And sometimes they say that...
Switching to Urdu, Adil tells me some Indians have even said they'd be too afraid to meet him in case he murders them. But he says most of the experiences are positive. Gay men in both countries face similar social challenges and discrimination. Kabir, not his real name, is one of the Indian men Adil talks to regularly.
Our countries are divided, but we are all humans. Our blood is the same colour.
Crossing the border to meet up in person is still nearly impossible, but sometimes the relationships do move into the real world.
I talked in India from since last 2 to 3 months, then we planned to meet together. And we decided that it's difficult to meet in anywhere in Pakistan or India. So we plan to go to Thailand. You learn many things from the other person. Even you meet with him only for the fun.
These men are amongst the many Pakistanis and Indians who hope one day there'll be better relations between the countries.
The BBC's Sukunder Kermani reporting from Lahore, Pakistan. Societies often change slowly, and shifts in values and allegiances can be so subtle you might miss them. A smart politician knows that. Consider how fascist leader Benito Mussolini consolidated power in Italy in the 1920s. He likened the process to carefully preparing a chicken for slaughter.
He said, if you pluck a chicken one feather at a time, people don't notice it.
That's former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, and she sees quite a bit of feather plucking happening around the world these days. She details it all in her new book, Fascism, A Warning.
If there is identification of one group that is supposed to represent the nation, kind of a tribal aspect, and the other people are then robbed of their rights, if there is statements against the press, that the press is the enemy of the people, if you have a leader who thinks he's above the law, and that also there's a great deal of propaganda and rallies used to rouse people in which there are even evidence of violence. So I think those are the major signs. Not every dictator is a fascist, whereas every fascist is a dictator. But it is that blending of what is coming up from the bottom, because people are dissatisfied with maybe their economic position or being discriminated against, and then having it melded in with a leader who then uses that disgruntlement from the bottom and, in fact, makes it even worse. Ultimately, a fascist is somebody that will use violence to attain power, a bully with an army. I'm very careful about whom I call fascist, but I actually do point out what I see some of the signs are.
Well, I guess, first of all, I need to be clear. Do you consider Donald Trump a fascist?
No, I do not call Donald Trump a fascist. I do think he is the most undemocratic American president of modern history. He does, in fact, blame the press for everything, the enemy of the people. He does seem not to have any respect for democratic institutions, the judiciary, for instance, in a number of different ways, and then also that he does act as if he's above the law. And so I do see some signs here, which is why I thought it was important to warn about it.
And, of course, Donald Trump was elected. How do you respond to a person like Donald Trump if you see him as undemocratic?
The leaders, whether Mussolini or Hitler, or the countries that I talk about, like Hungary and Poland and Turkey and Philippines and Venezuela, Mussolini and Hitler came in constitutionally by power being handed to them, and the others had been elected, which is one of the things that I think is scary and means basically that those of us that vote have to ask some very serious questions about what the leaders are doing, what do they believe in. And I think that there has not been enough analysis of some of the ways that President Trump behaves.
What's interesting about where we find ourselves today, though, is that, you know, we're public radio, we're interviewing you, you've been on other public radio programs, print outlets. Have you been on more conservative media like Fox?
I have. And Dana Perino interviewed me, and I was looking at the Twitter feed, and people are unbelievably critical of her for having done that, which I think is ridiculous. We have to talk to people we disagree with. We can't just listen to what we agree with. I do listen to you and public radio all the time, but you might be surprised. I actually listen to right-wing radio because I think it's very important to hear what people are saying and not just to have one source of information, because we do need to be respectful of the ideas of others.
But that's kind of the heart of the matter in terms of at least the U.S. I think the divisiveness in the U.S. is very much about everyone curating their own information feed. Based on your own experience and your own long career, what can we do about that? Because leaders don't have to hold rallies anymore. You have ways in to people online. And if there isn't a collective source of information, what is the way for people to reach across and be having the same conversation if one is worried about creeping authoritarianism?
I do think it's important for teachers to get their students to talk to people, the other students that they disagree with. I think there needs to be community activity where, in fact, there is a reaching out to those that have different views instead of, you know, I don't like the word tolerance because that's tolerate, to put up with. We need to be respectful. I think the social media issue is incredibly complicated because you can't tell people what not to listen to. I think you have to advise them on what they can add to their listening.
I'm curious about the moment you decided, yikes, I've got to write a book about fascism. Was it something a leader said, a foreign leader or Donald Trump? Was there something that you thought, oh boy, here we go?
Well, you know, actually, I was planning to write this book no matter who won. I was beginning to see things in Europe, for sure, the kinds of things that were going on in Hungary and what was going on in Poland, Turkey. But I did begin to see something in the United States, which was that there is very large income inequality now. But I did not expect to have what happened and to have a leader who is so undemocratic. I mean, that's what stuns me, that this is a man that has no sense about the real basis of our Constitution.
Do you think that President Trump is intentionally being undemocratic or unwittingly?
It's very hard for me to know what he's doing in that regard. I do think that there are those that are in his circle who were intentionally doing that. Steve Bannon, for one. And from what I read, I can see that a lot of it is intentional. And you certainly saw it at the rallies where there was an incitement even to violence. So I think that there are people around him that I think are doing it deliberately.
I wonder when the last time you couldn't sleep and what was it that was keeping you awake?
Well, actually, last night. I am at the moment, you know, on my book tour. What keeps me awake is that our country, people are so unhappy at the moment and lost in so many ways and are seeking answers. And I think that we are in kind of a muddled time, just exactly when we need leadership that can respect democracy and understand that the various elements of our country that work and not be kind of lost totally. So that does keep me awake. And I have a huge opportunity with this book because people are listening, but I don't have all the answers. And I do think that it's important to raise the questions and do the warning. And I especially think, given the kinds of things that are going on internally in our country, but also externally, given my own background, I so believe in the importance of American leadership. And America, the role of America on human rights and democracy and decency, that chair is empty at the moment. And people are waiting for America to behave the way that made me proud. I'm a grateful American. I want to be a proud American because our people are remarkable and our leadership is letting us down.
Madeleine Albright served as Secretary of State under President Bill Clinton. Her latest book is Fascism, A Warning. Madeleine Albright, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much.
And that's all from us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.